The American media often depicts Iran as a militant Islamic society, but in her newest memoir, Time magazine contributor and Iranian-American Azadeh Moaveni paints a much more complex portrait of young Iranians who live westernized lives in private but are forced to suppress themselves in public. She also tells her own story of falling in love and starting a family while living in Tehran. It's called Honeymoon in Tehran, 2 Years of Love and Danger in Iran. It's published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it brings Ms. Moaveni back to the show today. It's a pleasure to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
Haven't you just returned from Tehran?
Yes.
What were you doing there?
I spent about 3 weeks there visiting family and also doing a bit of reporting ahead of the upcoming presidential election.
Ahead of the one in Iran. What have the Iranians you've spoken to said about their feelings about our new president?
The young people that I spoke to, my sort of relatives and friends, were all very excited. It was seemed to me that there was sort of a hope again after all these years that there might be a possibility for rapprochement and a new direction between Iran and the U.S.
It's almost impossible to predict who's going to win in Iran because of the complications of the electoral system. But could you report anything other than anecdotal stories about a sense of how people feel about this new election?
Well, I spoke with some of the candidates, some of whom have been running polls, and the polls that they had run in December suggested that the moderate candidate, Khatami, who was president for 2 terms before Ahmadinejad, was polling 2-1 against Ahmadinejad, you know, had elections been held at that time.
But there's also at least press reports suggest that the fix is in and that Ahmadinejad is going to win because he has all the he has control over the media and he has the support of the Ayatollah Khamenei.
It's very true. But what we've seen is that the regime is able to fix elections around small margins. So they can sort of come up with 2 or 3 million votes by mobilizing all of the resources that you just mentioned. But they can't sort of fix 10 or 15 million, and that would be the margin by which Khatami would likely win.
On the other hand, when Khatami was in power the last time, he couldn't get much of what he wanted his program through because, again, the political system is kind of fixed, isn't it?
Very true. I mean, ultimate power rests with Khamenei, the religious unelected leadership, and so sort of significant policy change, sort of foreign policy, economic policy, was never able to sort of go through. But there were significant changes in terms of an ease up on censorship, sort of literature, film sort of flourished to an extent, and a sort of cultural space opened up. And that was, Iranians felt that as a very profound change in their lives.
And that was reversed when Ahmadinejad came to power.
Mm-hmm.
How is the global economic crisis affecting the lives of Iranians today?
What's actually having more of an effect, well, you know, the Iranian economy has been in shambles for so many years. So people have been, their quality of life has deteriorated, you know, from 1979 through now. But what's actually hurting the most is that, you know, the high oil prices that sort of were a boost to the rest of the Persian Gulf didn't really make much of a difference in Iran because Iran is sort of suffering from these multilateral sanctions over its nuclear program. So people are finding that they can't eat meat as much as they could before. Couples can't find apartments, can't get married. It's really gouging quality of life.
Now, your experience was that you were born in the United States because your parents had moved to California after the revolution in 1979. How did their experience shape your view of Iran before you went there?
My notions of Iran were sort of these honeyed, idyllic ideas of Iran of, you know, before the revolution of decades past and a very sort of dramatic and serious contrast with the Iran that I actually found, a very different sort of jasmine-scented life of ease.
Do you think that they were romanticizing it?
I think they were. I think it's a tendency of diasporas and exile to romanticize the homeland.
What made you decide to move to Tehran then?
Well, I was a reporter in the Middle East when I moved there in 2000, and I found that compared to Egypt and Jordan, sort of other places in the Middle East, Iran was the most fascinating, the sort of most dynamic youth culture, women's movement.
And you spoke Farsi because you'd spoken it in your home.
Exactly. Exactly.
You're one of the few foreign journalists who have worked in Iran for many years. How has the country changed from the time you first moved there a decade ago?
I think that the young generation that I've reported on throughout has become much more bitter, sadly. There's a baby boom generation that came about after the revolution that's sort of now in their early 30s, like I am, and have been very disappointed in, you know, the difficulties in sort of creating political or social change within the confines of the system. So it's very much sort of a nation of 30-year-olds who can't get decent jobs, who are engineers but can't afford to even get married, despairing, really.
You write that when you first moved to Iran in 2000, young Iranians played a sort of game living in what you refer to as an as-if society.
Yes, that was during the moderate era where that was permitted. You know, the regime permitted the as-if society. You know, they tolerated young people sort of holding hands in public and flouting the dress codes, and they permitted
letting hair show or letting a little bit of bright clothing come show out from underneath the black chador.
Exactly, or even just sort of bright, sort of figure hugging tunics, sort of all sorts of different kinds of variations on the official dress code.
I saw an Iranian film in which these young women walked around bareheaded, and every time there was any kind of a dangerous situation, they reached into a pocket in their chadors and pulled out the headscarves. So, because now they were going to have to deal with officials.
Yes, I've seen that very often, especially in places where women are exercising, sort of when they're hiking up the mountain or skiing or doing aerobics in the park, they sort of pull it out at the last moment.
And you talk about how Iranians are forced to live dual lives, behaving one way in public, another in private. Can you give us some examples of your own experience in that regard?
Absolutely. For example, the last couple times that I've been there, everyone has satellite television, which is officially banned. And so inside the home, they watch Western television, Western videos. They drink alcohol that they acquire through bootleggers who provide alcohol to much of much of middle class Tehran.
But isn't that banned by religion? Wouldn't even people who don't go along with the regime still follow the religious stricture?
You would be surprised. I think that middle class Iran is becoming very secular in its religiosity. I mean, people I think have become in the last 30 years so sort of alienated by official Islam that you'll see sort of even young people, my generation, I call it Islam light, because they fast during Ramadan and they'll even sort of not drink during that month, but when it's all over, they start going to parties and drinking.
Even though the Shiite branch of Islam is perhaps the stricter of the two?
I wouldn't necessarily say that it's...
Well, it has martyrdom and other things as a basic part of the culture.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's definitely that political element to it, or at least that sort of that cultural element of sacrifice and martyrdom. But there's also a little bit more space in Shiism, because there's a tradition of... it's not to get into the complicated bits of it, but there's a little bit more room for dissenting religious opinion. And so people, I think, are becoming more secular, sort of like many Christians and Jews in the West who will celebrate their holidays and consider themselves faithful, but will still drink alcohol. And
yet other groups, Baha'i especially, are now reporting being discriminated against. This is just official government policy?
Yes, very sadly, since the revolution, there's been a very serious policy of discrimination and harassment of Baha'is and sort of marginalization of other minorities, religious minorities.
Some people have written that it's impossible to understand the Iranian approach to Islam without recognizing that Iran had a great history before Islam even came to the country. Zoroastrianism was a very important influence on the culture, and of course memories of the Persian Empire remain a matter of national pride.
That's exactly right, and I think that's a very big part of Iranian culture. I mean, one of the biggest holidays of the year is Nowruz, which is the Persian New Year, with its origins in the spring equinox and pre-Islamic rituals. So that's a real living, breathing part of Iranian culture today, and it's in contrast and sometimes in opposition to Islam.
My guest is Azadeh Moaveni. She's the author of Lipstick Jihad and the co-author with Nobel Peace Prize laureate Shirin Ebadi of Iran Awakening. Her latest book is a memoir called Honeymoon in Tehran, 2 Years of Love and Danger in Iran. It's published by Random House. And as that title suggests, this is more than just about politics and Iranian society. It's about meeting your husband there.
Yes, we met while I was reporting the Iranian presidential election in 2005. So there was the Ahmadinejad surprise, and then there was a surprise in my life of finding someone that I was going to get married to.
Was your relationship typical of many young Iranian relationships?
It was, in the sense that we dated openly and spent time doing what a lot of young couples in Tehran do, sort of hiking in the mountains and spending time in coffee shops. Yeah, in that way it was.
But you also became pregnant before you got married. What are the rules about premarital sex in Iran?
The official rules are quite severe. It can be punished by flogging, and it very often is, or has become sort of more official sort of intolerance of it has become more pronounced recently. But for many years, it was sort of a tolerated reality that young Iranians were having premarital sex.
Well, since you're not wearing tight clothing, a chador can cover up at least a few months' pregnancy.
Yes, yes. Well, we sort of accelerated getting married, or tried to accelerate our marriage, but then I came across another hitch, which was that I needed my father's permission. My father was in California and not very happy with this whole business to begin with, so all became quite complicated.
And then after your husband proposed to you, you both had to attend Iranian premarital classes. What were they like?
That, to me, was fascinating because it was, they were segregated, of course, and it was sort of 10 women in a classroom with the teacher instructing us about birth control and contraception, but also very
much... And birth control and contraception are common in Iran?
They are. Actually, this is one of the real successes of the Islamic Republic in keeping down its birth rate. Widely available and a very effective program that they've got. But what was striking to me in these classes was that the teacher lectured all these young women about not having a child immediately because they might want to get divorced and they would have a better second chance the other way around, and also lecturing them about sex and how they should insist on their husbands, that they enjoy sexual relations as well. And obviously this is not traditional at all, so striking to me.
Well, they were aware of the fact that you were pregnant.
I only disclosed at the very last moment to the nurse because you're meant to get a vaccination as well, and I sort of whispered that I didn't want it, and she was very happy. She said no problem at all. So,
and then what surprised you about planning a wedding in Tehran?
Well, I hadn't been prepared for the fact that the Iranian wedding industry sort of rivals the American industry in sort of its commercial exuberance and excess. You know, not even just middle to upper class Iranians, but even working class Iranians aspire to these big, frothy weddings and these sort of wedding coordinators that are straight out of Hollywood movies. So that's sort of the quest of every young couple, is to have that kind of wedding.
And did you? Who paid for it?
We didn't. We had a smaller wedding, and my husband's family paid for it. That's the traditional way. But no, we sort of refused to have the 15 entree reception, which has sadly become really standard in Tehran in the middle class.
And then you gave birth to a child. Is it the same as having a baby anywhere in the world?
In a lot of ways it is, except for one one rather important difference, which is that husbands are not permitted in the delivery room, because very often there's more than one woman delivering in the same room, and couldn't have sort of men who are strangers to other women. So that was something that we had to maneuver around and try and get my husband there with me.
Now, you mentioned that people are watching satellite TV and very interested in Western culture. Why would they be interested in Western culture? After all, Iran, as we point out, has a rich history of its own, and it has a fair amount of grievances against the West, especially against the United States, which Ahmadinejad keeps on reminding us about, going all the way back to the overthrow of Mossadegh. So why do people even want to wear blue jeans and do all that other stuff?
I think part of it is this sense that the Western lifestyle symbolizes all of the freedom and the liberality that Iranians want in their own culture, but are having a hard time sort of bringing about in sort of negotiating tradition with these modern notions.
They don't associate it with the time of the Shah, which many people suffered through?
They did. But I think that those memories have sort of been replaced now by a different set of recollections, which was that under the Shah, people had better quality of life, universities were better, there were more jobs. And now sort of America is recalled as you know, not just an abettor to the Shah's crimes, but also what created a strong Iranian economy.
Now, you've reported for Time, the New York Times Book Review, the Washington Post, NPR, Los Angeles Times, major American publications. Did you ever face resistance from editors from some of the things that you were saying? Do we want to hear what we want to hear about Iran in this country?
I think that there have been
Iran, as many people have called it.
There have certainly been times where it seems like the media is really fixated on the scare and the threat of the Iranian nuclear program. And there isn't that much that I have experienced that there being not that much appetite among editors for stories that didn't really resonate with that mood or with that sort of frame of Iran. And so, yes, that's certainly something I've experienced, unfortunately.
And some people have pointed out that we focus a lot on Ahmadinejad when he really is not the most powerful person in the country.
No, he's not, although he's been a significant factor in foreign policy, but he's not the only player. He's not the most significant player. I think that he's played up to the part and sort of created the sort of boogeyman figure that he's caricatured as in the West, but there is sort of a wider Iranian leadership structure that we should be looking at.
Ahmadinejad was once the mayor of Tehran, the capital city, largest city, so people must have known what they were getting when they voted for him.
Well, he was an undistinguished mayor. I mean, as mayors go, he was sort of pretty much a failure, I would say. But because he presented himself very differently, he pitched himself as an economic populist, and that sort of had no bearing on his tenure as mayor. So he was able to cast himself as someone who was going to improve people's quality of life, and so they gave him a chance.
And but you say that many Iranians boycotted the election. They just felt that no matter who they voted for, they weren't going to get what they wanted?
Well, after sort of 8 years of blocked reform, under Khatami, there was a sense that political change through the system was just not happening. And so the silent majority, that's called, didn't vote because they figured, you know, if the reform candidate can't push through change anyway, then what's the point in this whole process?
Now, during the presidential campaign, then-candidate Obama talked about just sitting down with Ahmadinejad or anyone else from Iran without any preconditions. That outraged a lot of people in this country. Do you think that the United States has been handling diplomatic relations with Iran very well in the last few years?
I think the policy of the Bush administration has been a real failure. I mean, it's been a policy of sort of belittling and refusing to deal with or even speak to Iran. And I think that, very sadly, it's portrayed in the American media that sort of sitting down at the negotiating table is itself a concession, which is just a very mistaken idea of diplomacy, which is that you sit down with your enemy and you can negotiate your way out of a fraught relationship. And the real work happens at the table, not sort of standing aside and refusing to speak.
Were there particular challenges you faced covering Iranian politics because you were a foreign journalist?
Not so much because I was a foreign journalist, no. I mean, I think that I've always been able to have reasonably good access.
How's your accent?
It's better. It's improved.
Because people would spot you right away as someone who wasn't native born.
Yes, exactly. They would sort of assume that I was one of the generation that sort of spent half my life outside and then came back.
You were assigned a government minder, a Mr. X, who followed your every move for a while. Didn't that make it more difficult to be a reporter?
That's something that that most Iranian journalists have to deal with, and it does make it harder.
Not just foreign, any Iranian journalists?
Yes, Iranian journalists. Foreign journalists, for the most part, unless they have Iranian background, don't have to deal with this. But yes, I mean, it's sort of, it's intimidating to have a minder, and that's the point of it. It sort of makes you much more careful and cautious in the kind of stories that you write and pick and try and write in a way that your readers can read between the lines.
You write about Iran. Something in our culture nurtures tyranny and has for centuries. What do you mean by that?
I think that Iranians don't accept responsibility for the role they've played in what's happened in the 20th century to their country.
So this doesn't predate Islam? This is something that's only happened in the last 100 or so years?
No, I think that it's a long-running tradition. I think that autocratic monarchy has been the Iranian model for centuries, literally centuries. And I think that that's something that society has tolerated and been complicit in.
Can you imagine a time when there's going to be more cooperation between the United States and Iran? Or is that possible as long as people almost automatically say death to America?
Well, I think because that's not the view of most Iranians, that there's a lot of hope for building common ground, because there are very, very specific ways that the U.S. and Iran share interests. There's Iraq, there's Afghanistan, there's dealing with, sort of right-wing Sunni groups that are fanatical, like al-Qaeda, that are a threat to both countries. So I think there's a lot of common ground.
Although there are many people who will claim that Iran is the winner in the war with Iraq.
It's certainly proven to be Iran's advantage. I mean, I think it's ironic that Iran sort of failed to export its Islamic revolution throughout the region, but it's these two U.S. interventions that have actually enabled Iran to extend its influence.
Why did you and your husband make the decision to leave Iran?
We didn't really envision that we could raise a family in that kind of atmosphere. Too unstable, and it seemed to me too difficult to be able to impart our values and our liberal attitudes sort of successfully and in a climate that was so anarchic and so in so many ways still very fundamentalist.
But he has to feel a little like a fish out of water in this country, doesn't he?
In the UK, where we are?
Yeah, you live in London now.
Yeah, we live in London, and it's very multicultural. So in that sense, I think that we sort of feel like we're in a city composed of people from different places.
What would it take for you to move back to Iran?
To move back to Iran and sort of build a life there, I mean, I think that we would need to see continuity in moderate government. You know, sort of 4 years here, 8 years there of more moderate government isn't enough to sort of build a life on.
And do you think that Khatami has a chance to win the election?
I think he will win. I mean, I think that I think he has an excellent chance, and I think society backs him. So I think that everything is lined up for that to happen.
Do you believe the claims of the Iranian government that its nuclear program is simply a peaceful program?
I think that the record that we've seen of the technological breakthroughs that they've been striving for suggests that they are trying to acquire the knowledge to be able to weaponize. Whether that step is taken or whether the sort of enrichment becomes more of a priority, I think it becomes a political question in terms of relations with the West.
A caller wanted to know what everyday Iranians think about Israel.
Everyday Iranians, I think, are sympathetic to Palestinians, but also don't believe that there's any sort of intrinsic reason why Israel needs to be Iran's enemy.
I think there were peaceful relations in the past. In fact, during the Shah's time, Iran was Israel's best ally in the area, wasn't it?
Exactly, and people are very aware of that today, and people have been very resentful of Iran's support for groups like Hamas and Hezbollah. They feel that it's something that that Iranians have to bear the burden of.
But it is official policy, and Iran is one of the most outspoken critics of Israel in the area.
Yes, it's definitely sort of a foundation of the regime, sort of opposition to Israel. But I think these are one of the things that young people especially are frustrated with.
My guest, Azadeh Moaveni, will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at McNally Jackson Books on 52 Prince. That's at Mulberry Street. Her book, Honeymoon in Tehran, is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.